This recording is the property of the Winogren Foundation and cannot be used, quoted, or transcribed or otherwise rebroadcast without the express permission of the Foundation. This is New York Academy of Sciences Anthropology Section Lecture for April 30th, 2012, The New Language Detectives, Investigating Linguistic Phenomena in a Data-Driven Age. This is by Ben Zimmer of ThinkMap, Inc. in the Boston Globe, best known for previously penning the column On Language in the New York Times.
Welcome, everyone, to Winogren. I'm Leslie Aiello. I'm the president of the Winogren Foundation, and we're very pleased, as always, to host the anthropology section of the New York Academy of Science. We're also, very pleased that you're all here. Our major role in life at Winogren is to support international anthropology. We have a variety of funding programs. If any of you are interested in getting money from us, I'll be quite happy to, talk with you at the end of the program. But right now, I want to turn it over to Rudy, who's going to, I think, pass out sign-up sheets.
Well, I will just reiterate Leslie's welcome. I'm Rudy Gaudia, one of the co-chairs. I'm going to let my co-chair, Jeff Moskovsky, introduce our speaker. I just want to thank you for coming, and we'd like to know who's here, if you've been here before or if you haven't. So I'm going to be passing out these three sign-in sheets, if you could just sign one of them. And just seeing your name would be great. If you want to give us any contact information that you're comfortable sharing, that would be great, too. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. Before I introduce tonight's speaker, Ben Zimmer, I want to announce that our 2012-2013 speaker series will begin in mid-September, probably on Monday, September 10th. 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 I know something you don't know. So don't correct the speaker. 10th, with a talk by Sandra Morgan from the University of Oregon about taxes and the politics of redistribution in the United States, based on her Winogren-funded research in Oregon and other Western states, to give a little synergistic plug here. And now that I've announced our first speaker for the 2012-2013 speaker series, I have the great pleasure of introducing our last speaker for the 2011-2012 series. His dissertation field work took place in Indonesia, and he received several prestigious research fellowships, including ones from the National Science Foundation, the Fulbright Program, and the Ford Foundation. He has since taught courses on language and culture at UCLA, Kenyon College, and Rutgers University. In addition to his distinguished academic pedigree, he is also a paragon of public intellectualism in a discipline whose practitioners frequently celebrate public engagement but often fail to achieve it. And indeed, it is his unique and spectacular career as a public linguistic anthropologist that first brought him to our attention and that heightens the privilege of having him here tonight. His accomplishments in this area are too numerous to mention, but let me share with you a few highlights. In 2009, he began writing guest columns for On Language in New York Times Magazine, and in March 2010, he became William Sapphire's successor. He is thus, I think, the most public linguistic anthropologist in the United States and perhaps the world. He wrote that column until February 2011. A reviewer of his columns and of his postings in the very popular Language Log, where he has contributed online posts since 2005, tells us that Zimmer has, quote, perfected the art of the short essay or squib that pieces together the citational history, to use his own phrase, of a particular term or idiom. In December 2011, he became language columnist for the Boston Globe. His non-academic career has also included extensive work in lexicography, and a consultant for the Oxford English Dictionary and as an editor for U.S. dictionaries at Oxford University Press. He is also executive producer for Visual Thesaurus, a go-to website for language lovers. He also posts a regular column there called Word Roots. In his pioneering efforts in the new public linguistics, Ben Zimmert, has paid a great deal of attention to the coming linguistics trends, and in particular to increasing technologization of language and language consumption and production. This brings us to his talk today, entitled The New Language Detectives, Interrogating Linguistic Phenomena in a Data-Driven Age. After his talk, we will hear from two discussants whom I will introduce. Please now join me in welcoming Ben Zimmert to the New York Academy of Sciences at Wintergreen.
Thank you for that very kind introduction. Thank you all for coming out. So in August of 2010, which is about 5 months after I had been named the successor to the late William Safire as on-language columnist for the New York Times Magazine, Melissa Checker got in touch with me to ask if I would be interested in reflecting on my experiences and taking over the column as part of the public anthropology reviews section of American Anthropologist. So despite my background in linguistic anthropology at the University of Chicago, I had not at that point given much thought to how my writing for the New York Times and other outlets could be considered a form of public linguistic anthropology. So intrigued by the prospect of framing my work in this way, I agreed to write a short piece. It was to be for the June 2011 issue of the journal, Thinking Far Ahead, and it was to be accompanied by an essay by Rob Moore, the linguistic anthropologist, as a dialogic reviews, as they call it. But a funny thing happened on the way to publication. As the issue was going through its final review stage early last year, news emerged that the on-language column would be coming to a close as part of the redesign of the New York Times Magazine under a new editorship. But there was enough time before the issue of American Anthropologist went to press to append postscripts to the review essays. And in my addendum, I pointed to my valedictory column that ran in the February 27th, 2011 edition of the New York Times Magazine entitled The Future Tense. And as the headline suggested, I chose not to dwell on the past, but to look ahead to coming linguistic trends, particularly the increasing technologization of language in both consumption and production. So in the year or so since On Language came to a close, this theme has been at the forefront of my writing in new venues. That includes some other parts of the New York Times, like the Sunday Review and book review sections, the Technology Channel of the Atlantic, the Ideas section of the Sunday Boston Globe, which now, since late last year, I've taken up residence as language columnist. So I still enjoy delving into the hidden histories of words. Recent columns have been about the word jazz or even the word supercalifragilisticexpialidocious I wrote about recently. Beyond that style of writing, I've tried to expand my palette by spending more time examining this intersection of language and technology in order to better understand exactly how this era of big data that we find ourselves in is leading to major transformations in the way that language is being dissected across a whole range of disciplines. And so there have been a number of topics that I've explored and written about and will continue to write about. And just to sketch out some of them, sure. Various data-driven approaches to language. So one group of topics that we can look at is advances in natural language processing, NLP, not to be confused with neuro-linguistic programming, very different. Sometimes also called human language technology, or HLT. And the big things that people have been talking about in the past year or so are actually all commercial enterprises. So we've got the question answering task that IBM's supercomputer Watson performed quite well on Jeopardy, beating the humans. We have examples of speech recognition and human-computer interaction with Siri from Apple's iPhone at the forefront of that. And we have new work being done with machine translation, and Google Translate has been a major success there as well. So that's sort of one bundle of things to talk about. Oops, I pressed the wrong button. Sorry about that. Another one has to do with analyzing language in what I'm calling mega corpora. So corpora have been built for research purposes and looking at language in the past, but now we have enormous corpora, the Google Books corpus, and from that Google Books corpus, something called the N-gram corpus, which I'll describe, as well as a new field of study with the name culturomics, which we'll also talk a bit about. And I've looked at various ways that these large corpora of texts can now be looked at for all sorts of different purposes, including computing literary style, a kind of a stylometry of literature and other genres that can be done with the advent of these enormous corpora with lots of texts covering lots of genres. And even how all of this can now be used for legal evidence in court cases. And then a third bundle of topics have to do with tracking communicative behavior of various types. And some of the things I've looked at are ways that this data-driven approach to language are giving new insights or at least suggesting new approaches in things like authorship analysis, which is done in the field of forensic linguistics. The idea that you might be able to find what's sometimes called a write print, that would be some sort of linguistic fingerprint that could then be identified for later attribution, again, very often having to do with legal cases. And then social psychologists who lately have been doing a lot of word counting using a particular software program called LIWC, L-I-W-C, which I'll talk about as well. And then finally, Twitterology, using the enormous corpus of very small texts that one can collect from Twitter to look at all sorts of interesting behaviors of various kinds. And this has a lot of bearing on what's called sentiment analysis, as well as suggesting new possibilities for the study of dialectal distribution and many other possibilities. What cuts across all of the recent research here that I want to talk about here is that there's a sense that language has become a new type of commodity in scholarly and technological fields, thanks to the ability to perform various types of linguistic data mining on an unprecedented scale. So there's been understandable excitement about the possibility of NLP being used to tackle questions that 5 years ago, 10 years ago, might have seemed unanswerable, thanks to rapid improvements in the ability to collect and analyze mountains of language data. So the rush to exploit all of this data in new ways has in some quarters led to a kind of starry-eyed techno-utopianism, and in other quarters to a hard-nosed skepticism about the limitations of strictly data-driven approaches to spoken and written communication. So there's a tension here, and I witnessed this tension, the tension between these two perspectives last month when I went to the South by Southwest Interactive Conference, the annual mecca for the techno-savvy in Austin, Texas. One of the keynote speakers was Ray Kurzweil. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Mr. Kurzweil. He is a scientist and inventor turned futurist who has been predicting the coming singularity, the singularity being the point at which computer intelligence surpasses human intelligence and perhaps gets fused together with human intelligence, all sorts of futuristic scenarios. Ray Kurzweil suggests that this singularity is nigh, finally arriving. I believe he's currently predicting in 2029, so be prepared. So as evidence for the coming singularity, he gave a couple of bits of current language-related technology as examples of the direction that we're headed. There was, of course, Siri, the natural language user interface for the iPhone, and Watson, IBM's silicon-based Jeopardy champion. And in the case of the speech technology of Siri, he discerned that what he called an amazing threshold had been crossed of people talking to their computers. And he admitted this represents first-generation software, but he saw Siri as a bold step on the road to satisfying the Turing test. That's the thought experiment introduced by Alan Turing back in 1950 that imagined an artificial intelligence that could interact linguistically with humans so credibly that its interlocutors would not know whether it was machine-based or not. So Watson was proof, he said, that we're making computers understand language. And let me just, if I could, play a little excerpt of what he said there.
I think the biggest push is the commercial value of computers that have more and more intelligence. Last time I checked, Google was doing pretty well. And it's doing things with word sequences. I mean, it is doing what people attribute to Watson, which is dealing with sequences of words. Watson actually is understanding what those sequences mean in terms of concepts to be able to match it against concepts that it's read.
Watson actually is understanding what those sequences of words mean. That's a bit of an overblown claim about Watson's abilities, which were of course, very impressive. But it actually matched the hype that IBM itself had built up about Watson in the weeks leading up to the Jeopardy showdown in February of 2011. And there were a number of commercial spots. Maybe you saw them. They were kind of all over the place early last year. They aired during NFL playoff games. And here's one example. If you could put it back to the beginning, yeah. Press play.
Morning, I shot an elephant in my pajamas. How he got in my pajamas, I don't know.
Real language is filled with nuance, slang, and metaphor. It's more than half the world's data, but computers couldn't understand it. Watson is a computer that uncovers meaning in our language and pinpoints the right answer instantly. It uses deep analytics to answer questions computers never could before, even the ones on Jeopardy. That's what I'm working on. I'm an IBMer. Let's build a smarter planet.
So that was Dave Ferrucci there, the lead engineer on the Watson project, telling us that that Watson was basically understanding these Jeopardy clues. And while Watson's performance in the tournament, despite a few howlers along the way, clearly demonstrated that it's very skilled in particular this particular type of question answering. And, you know, I think it could probably handle that Groucho clue that you saw in the commercial. It has the ability to answer these questions, or, of course, in Jeopardy it's reversed, but let's just say it's answering questions. And it does this by parsing the clue into different keywords that it could then use to find statistically related words and phrases among its many terabytes of reference data, the entirety of Wikipedia, and many other sources that it's able to look through and then evaluate the possible responses to determine if one of them passes its confidence threshold, and then it would press the buzzer if it felt confident enough. But does all of this mean that Watson understands, as he says, the nuanced slang and metaphor of natural language, that it uncovers meaning in our language? Well, it depends on what you mean by meaning and how you understand understanding. In other contexts, other than this commercial push that IBM was doing in advance of the Jeopardy tournament, Dave Ferrucci's been more circumspect about Watson's level of so-called understanding. So he did an interview with IBM's magazine Forward View, and he said, "For a computer, there's no connection from words to human experience and human cognition. The words are just symbols to the computer. How does it know what they really mean?" So, in other words, for all of the impressive NLP that's gone into Watson, the computer was unable to penetrate the semantics of language or comprehend how meanings of words are shot through with allusions to human culture and the experience of daily life. Despite all of those caveats, Watson's Jeopardy performance was truly impressive and has actually emboldened other artificial intelligence researchers to take on similarly data-driven statistical approaches to natural language tasks. One of them, if I can get control of the clicker here, let's see. Interesting. Can you click off of the video? There we go. Thank you. One of them is a crossword-solving computer program called Dr. Phil, which was designed by Matthew Ginsburg, and it can run on his notebook computer. So at the American Crossword Puzzle Tournament just last month in Brooklyn, Dr. Phil speed-solved puzzles along human competitors. It wasn't officially in the running. Only humans could really compete in the tournament. Dr. Phil actually performed rather disappointingly from Ginsburg's perspective. He had done simulations of tournament play in which it occasionally finished first. Unfortunately, there were a couple of very, very tricky puzzles that meant that it ended up placing 141st out of nearly 600 contestants. So there were two out of the seven tournament puzzles that had some unexpected wordplay and grid construction. This is just an example here of the way that Dr. Phil goes about filling in the grid by analyzing the clues, somewhat in the manner of Watson analyzing the clues on Jeopardy, and then trying to come up with a high enough confidence level for responses. Now, what Matthew Ginsburg has put into its reference data, Dr. Phil's reference data, includes basically all of the clues from all of the major crossword puzzles for going back many years, so that if it sees a particular clue, it can sometimes identify right away because it's seen it in other puzzles. Other times it's going to have to make educated guesses of various kinds, and you can see it doesn't always get everything right. This is a case where you can see that the yellow squares indicate wrong squares that were filled in with the wrong letters. And this is an example of the type of crossword theme that might cause problems for Dr. Phil, because in fact it's what's called a quotation theme, where it just has a long series of words that you would not find, for instance, as the heading of a Wikipedia entry or a dictionary entry. So that makes life difficult for Dr. Phil. You know, this one is supposed to read, sipping on a glass of wine. This is an imagined conversation, I guess, between a husband and wife in this one. Sipping on a glass of wine, the man says, I'm still crazy about you, right? I can't live without you. Do you really mean that? Is that the wine talking? It's me talking to the wine. So an elaborate imagined conversation. And the best that Dr. Phil could do was to guess, well, if I, you know, put these letters together, they actually form a series of dictionary words, even though it has no idea what those things might actually mean. And, you know, one line of that, do you really mean that, it did actually get correctly. It tends to do better overall on your regular run-of-the-mill puzzles. It will solve them far more quickly than a human could. And so that's how it was able to compete in the tournament, even if it was making errors, which you're penalized for in the American Crossword Puzzle Tournament. The speed at which it could solve meant that it could accrue more points in the scoring system because it was just so much faster than the humans. But there will always be puzzles that it would just never be able to solve because of highly unorthodox techniques, which crossword puzzle solvers and constructors love. And this is one example of a particularly fiendish New York Times puzzle from 2010, where the theme entries involve having to rotate the puzzle sometimes sideways, sometimes upside down. And so you can see this one, 43 across, Noisisuinu. Well, that's actually moon missions upside down. And so the clue is something like Apollo 12 and 13, 180 degrees. So you have to turn it 180 degrees. So that's the type of thing that even if Matthew Ginsburg is able to load up Dr. Phil with lots of different algorithms or lots of different knowledge about the geography of the grid, or and also do more parsing of the clues the way that Watson parsed clues, different from understanding them, but at least breaking down the grammar of the clue in order to say, ah, this is a clue for a noun, I should be looking for a noun. A plural noun, I should be looking for a plural noun, that sort of thing. All these sorts of things that he can put into it. But there will always be this element of human creativity, sometimes diabolical creativity, that would seem to be a barrier that Dr. Phil couldn't cross. But it's interesting because when I talked to Ginsberg about this, it was very different from the way that you heard the IBM commercial talking about Watson. He certainly doesn't think that a crossword solving program or a Jeopardy program could understand natural language. He stresses that the way that Dr. Phil goes about solving is, as he says, really very inhuman. So machine intelligence, even when making impressive showings against carbon-based counterparts in linguistic undertakings, is still fundamentally different from human intelligence. So this question-answering task that you see with Watson and Dr. Phil actually represents a decades-old research area in artificial intelligence. And another AI chestnut is machine translation, or MT, which has seen major strides in recent years with this move to a data-driven statistical approach. Traditionally, the method since the advent of the Cold War, because we wanted to be able to translate Russian on the fly, was very rule-based. You create a map of semantic, morphological, syntactic regularities between a source language and a target language. This approach was largely abandoned in the U.S., at least. In the mid-60s, there was a government-commissioned report called ALPAC, A-L-P-A-C, that determined that MT just wasn't really getting anywhere and wasn't really deserving of further investment, and that you could just use human translators. It would be more accurate and less expensive. So that kind of put MT on hold for a while. But certainly by the 1990s, interest in MT began to return, often from commercial enterprises, with statistical MT replacing rule-based MT. So they abandoned attempts to map grammatical rules from one language to another. Instead, they work from language models that are developed by analyzing parallel corpora, large collections of texts that have been translated by humans. So you have the United Nations, for instance, generating all of these texts that have to be translated into their six official languages. So right there, you have this immense six-way corpus in the six official languages of the organization, and you can then look at that, sort of train your automatic translator to look for statistical correlations between language pairs in these parallel corpora, and that's what's become the basis for online automatic translation services, most notably Google Translate. Franz Oak is the lead engineer for Google Translate, and he just recently, last week I think, announced that after 6 years of development, the system has more than 200 million active users translating among 64 different languages, including such languages as Bengali and Basque and Swahili, Yiddish, Esperanto. These are languages that don't necessarily even have much of a web presence, but are now available as part of this service. And Oak says that what all the professional human translators in the world produce in a year, our system translates in roughly a single day. By this estimate, most of the translation on the planet is now done by Google Translate. This is just part of the a screenshot from their YouTube video explaining how it works with nice illustrations where it's showing the way like a parallel text would work and how instead of, again, trying to do careful mappings of the lexicon and the grammar and so forth, you would just see coche in a Spanish text and creta in a Malay text, and that you would be able to tell that those things correspond because they co-occur statistically often without even necessarily even needing to know that they're both sort of referring to cars. I just added at the bottom here, one of the things, because of course Google owns YouTube, one thing that they've added is the ability to put on captions, which can be created by the user or automatically generated. they had captions for this one, which you could then choose to translate automatically into various languages. So for this one, I just turned on one of the choices. Anybody have any idea what language I turned on?
Maltese.
Maltese. Well done. That's Maltese, yes. So one of the... Very nice. So despite this rapid success, anyone who's spent any time with Google Translate knows its severe limitations, especially when dealing with language pairs that do not involve English. So it remains primarily useful for gisting purposes, getting the gist of a document, understanding its essentials. But it's not going to be putting professional human translators out of a job anytime soon. Still, the easy accessibility of Google Translate, as with so many other language technology successes, has become somewhat taken for granted in a world increasingly mediated by various forms of NLP. So, you know, we may grumble about problems with Google Translate, problems with being misunderstood by Siri, or being inappropriately auto-corrected when we're instant messaging. But such complaints are predicated on the expectation now that our computing devices should be able to understand what we say and type and respond to us appropriately. So Google has been at the forefront of this data-centric approach to human language technology, not just in the arena of translation. For Google, building these mega collections of language data has always been seen as a key for their very profitable enterprise. And this began, of course, with the indexing of millions of web pages and the algorithmic retrieval of an ordered list of results to best match a search query. But their ambition soon spread beyond online text to the printed word. So in 2004, it began partnering with research libraries to scan and digitize their holdings. Almost from the beginning, the project has been mired in legal wrangling with authors and publishers over compensation for in-copyright works. But the digitization has nonetheless continued quite rapidly. Now we have an estimated 20 million books scanned out of what Google estimates is 130 million unique books in the world. So this resulting corpus clearly outstrips all others, but the collected texts have not really been fully available for research purposes. In large part, that's due to Google's natural wariness over the ongoing legal disputes they're dealing with. But there are actually a couple of postdoctoral scholars at Harvard who've managed to convince Google to provide them access to the data to answer a variety of quantitative research questions about the history of language and culture, which they've dubbed culturomics, in a blockbuster paper that appeared in the journal Science in January of last year. So as part of this effort, Google has also created a publicly available tool known as the Ngram Viewer, creating graphs of word frequency over time. So I just put in cultural anthropology, physical anthropology, and linguistic anthropology just to see how they have fared since you can see the turn of the 20th century when physical anthropology begins to rise. But then, you know, in the 40s and 50s, you get the big push with cultural anthropology. And you know, ever since then, cultural anthropology has had a higher frequency. And way down there is linguistic anthropology getting a little bit of attention starting in the 60s and 70s. So people have been having a lot of fun with the Ngram viewer and creating these graphs. And the way it works is that basically Google takes from that enormous corpus of all the texts that it has as part of Google Books and creates what's called an Ngram corpus. This is a way Google can actually avoid any copyright concerns because you're slicing and dicing the texts into small clusters of words. So with the maximum N of the Ngram set at 5, so a maximum of 5 consecutive words. So these are limited windows of text. There's a downside to that, of course. Unlike other large-scale corpora, you can't really adequately parse these n-grams at a clause or sentence level because generally that's beyond that window of 5 words. But you can do all sorts of fun things with these smaller clusters. So similar to the Google Translate project, the grammatical patterning of language is put to the side in favor of just amassing as much data as you possibly can. That's really Google's solution to any problem. So the colossal size of this data set is also supposed to offset any errors in the digitization process, of which there are many, not just at the level of, for instance, optical character recognition in the actual scanning, but also the metadata that's attached to each volume, such as date and place of publication. There's a lot of erroneous information, as I'm sure many of you know if you've spent time with it. What the culturomics researchers did was they took a smaller, more limited data set that ostensibly provides cleaner data, at least for the period of 1800 to 2000. So that's what you're looking at when you use this interface, the Ngram viewer. So they call all of this new research culturomics. And I first heard this word at the Google Books Summit in 2010, which was a few months before the Science paper went public. I was co-presenting one of the keynote addresses with Jesse Scheidlauer, the Oxford English Dictionary, on how Google Books was helping to transform historical lexicography. And the other keynote was Erez Lieberman-Aden and Jean-Baptiste Michel, or J.B. Michel. You can see them here. And they gave a bit of a preview of the Science paper, which at that time was really being rushed into print. There was a lot of excitement about it. And I found it very exciting and fascinating and of obvious utility, but I balked a little at some of their premises, as well as the name that they had given the project, Culturomics. It's not culturomics. The ending does not come from economics. It's culture plus omics from genomics, which implies that there's some sort of cultural equivalent to the genome that's available for quantitative analysis, and that this culturome would be reflected in the collected text artifacts of Google Books. Now these researchers come out of backgrounds in applied mathematics, systems biology, so the analogy with genomics, and there are various other omics too, there's proteomics, connectomics, etc., was clear to them. But the culture element in this is, of course, one that many cultural anthropologists, I think, would find vexing. But this research is, I would say, blissfully unencumbered by the long-standing arguments over locating culture in the cultural. They were also unencumbered by concerns over the proper identification and quantification of lexical items. They arrived at certain ad hoc delineations of what counts as words in the data set that they analyzed. So this allowed them to posit what they termed the lexical dark matter that dictionaries had overlooked. But I would say there was no real serious consideration to the varying criteria for inclusion that lexicographers grapple with every day. But they really have been admirably open in discussing the ramifications of their work with linguists, lexicographers, historians, and so forth. But this culturomics paper has also inspired a lot of, I would say, positivistic studies of language that seem to exist in a scholarly vacuum. So just recently, a group of physicists published a paper in Scientific Reports identifying birth rates and death rates of words in a few languages that are included, English, Spanish, and Hebrew, based on this Ngram data. So they adopt something of a particle model of words, with each particle battling for space, words battling with synonyms and spelling variants. But ultimately, it's really not actually about words. It's about these, you know, letter strings that appear in the output of the scanning and digitization project. And if a word is split from one line to another, you know, that counts as two words. And if there's an error in the OCR, the scanning process, then that counts as different words. And so what you might actually be seeing there are information that's really about typographical anomalies. So, for instance, the long S, which is often misidentified as an F by optical character recognition. But there are more linguistically informed approaches to this type of analysis, and the result can be quite rewarding, actually. There are a couple of other corpora which are significantly smaller than the Google Ngram corpus, compiled by Mark Davies at Brigham Young University, and they've become really vital public resources for those interested in tracking English patterns, particularly American English patterns over time. So there's the Corpus of Historical American English, COHA, and the Corpus of Contemporary American English, COCA. These corpora have been grammatically tagged, so they use an automated part-of-speech tagger with pretty good level of accuracy, and so you can actually get to the syntactic roles of words being queried in the search interface, which means you can construct more sophisticated questions about language rather than just typing in, you know, a series of words like in the Ngram viewer. And you don't even really need a whole background in corpus linguistics in order to work with it. So, you know, one example, I wrote about this in the New York Times Book Review, was about corpus-based insights into literary style. And, you know, what you can see quickly with this type of corpus is that you can break down the big corpus into sub-corpora of different genres. And this is the way that COCA is divided up between among spoken, fiction, magazine, newspaper, and academic sources. And you can actually quickly find out, well, tell me all the verbs that appear in fiction much more frequently than other genres. And then you end up things like grimace, where you can see it's far more frequently used in fiction than anywhere, than in the other genres. And you can actually see, I don't know how well you can read that, but you can pull up all the examples that it has in its corpus of that verb, grimace. Turns out words like grimace, scowl, grunt, wiggle, grit, those occur much more frequently in literary prose than elsewhere. And the same holds for longer collocations, combinations of words like bolt upright or draw one's breath, or in this case, brush one's hair or brush someone else's hair. In this search, I'm just looking for the verb brush occurring within five words of hair, and you can see some of the examples of hair brushing that goes on in literature. So it's interesting because these are not necessarily things we think of as literary. Words and phrases might not stand out as literary on first glance to us, but they're among the subtle cues that signal to us that we're consuming a literary genre. They're a kind of comfortable linguistic furniture that we can settle into. Now, the legal world, too, has begun to take notice of these resources. And last year, the Supreme Court actually drew on some linguistic expertise in its ruling that corporations are not entitled to personal privacy, which rebuffed arguments from the plaintiff in the case, which was AT&T. This is not the Citizens United case. This is a separate issue entirely dealing with statutes rather than the constitutional issue of Citizens United. So the idea was that AT&T should deserve protection because they can be considered persons under the law, and personal is just the adjective form of the noun person, is what the AT&T lawyers said. But there was a unanimous opinion against AT&T's position, and Chief Justice John Roberts said that there is no grammatical imperative dictating that the legal meaning of a noun must extend to a corresponding adjective. This is the Chief Justice of the United States filling us in on these things. And so Roberts actually gave some interesting examples of different words and phrases, but he also pulled out a litany of two-word phrases in which personal describes something we associate with humans, not big corporations. So John Roberts says, we do not usually speak of personal characteristics, personal effects, personal correspondence, personal influence, or personal tragedy as referring to corporations or other artificial entities. This is not to say that corporations do not have correspondence, influence, or tragedies of their own, only that we do not use the word personal to describe them. So where was Chief Justice Roberts getting this from? Was he just pulling it out of his head? Well, it turns out there was empirical evidence backing up the statement, even though it was not explicitly mentioned in the opinion. There was an amicus brief that helped shape the decision by Neil Goldfarb, filing on behalf of the Project on Government Oversight. And he found evidence to support the idea that the word personal is typically used for human beings. Seems a little intuitive. But in the oral arguments, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg made AT&T's lawyers look rather foolish by citing the brief's dozens and dozens of examples to show that overwhelmingly personal is used to describe an individual, not an artificial being. And I just have right here the top 10 that come from COHA, the Corpus of Historical American English. That is what Neil Goldfarb used in order to determine what the most common nouns are, modified by personal. He restricted his search to the 50s, 60s, and 70s to find these examples. He was able to do that. It's very easy, again, to sort of focus on a particular time period. In this case, that mattered because they really cared about the 1970s. That's when Congress enacted the Freedom of Information Act exemption that AT&T was wrangling over. This corpus revolution has a lot of promise, I think, for putting judicial inquiries into language patterns on a firmer, more systematic footing. But these results, of course, are still prey to all manner of human interpretation. You could have a strict originalist, someone like Justice Scalia, who might find solace in the ability to pinpoint what he might see as the meaning of ordinary language at different historical junctures. But, of course, those who might see the law as more protean, subject to changes in meaning over time, would instead focus on revelations about the ever-shifting nature of word usage. But at least these ideological arguments can proceed on a basis of concrete facts about how we use language, rather than on a welter of idiosyncratic assumptions, as has often been the case in the past. Now, there's another area of legal inquiry that promises to be transformed by new data-driven methods, and that's the forensic analysis of authorship attribution. When legal teams need to prove or disprove the authorship of key texts, they call in the forensic linguists. And scholars in the field have tackled disputed origins of some prestigious works. You might know about Shakespearean sonnets or the Federalist Papers, where forensic linguists have tried to do some authorship analysis of texts that are of uncertain origin. But how reliably could a linguistic expert establish that person A wrote document X when document X was, let's say, an email, or let's say a tweet on Twitter even? The much, much smaller bits of text, how much purchase do we really have on the author's idiosyncrasies as opposed to an extended work of literature? And this was a question that became a key point in the lawsuit, which is actually still ongoing, filed by Paul Seglia against Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg. Seglia claimed that that there was a contract that he arranged for Zuckerberg, a work-for-hire contract, back when Zuckerberg was still a freshman at Harvard, and he said this entitled Seglia to half of the Facebook fortune. And he backed up his claim with not just the contract may or may not be forged, but also emails, which he said came from Zuckerberg at the time. Facebook's lawyers say that it's all fabricated. And in order to back up this claim, they called in Gerald McMenamin. He's emeritus professor of linguistics at California State University, Fresno, to study the alleged Zuckerberg emails. And he determined that it's probable, as he said, that Mr. Zuckerberg is not the author of the questioned writings. And he reached this conclusion by doing a comparison of what he called style markers. You can see the 11 that he selected here, and you can see that it includes variant forms of punctuation, spelling, syntax, and discourse markers. This type of forensic stylistics that Gerald McMenamin conducted, though, is really falling out of favor. And when this became public, I was writing about it, I heard a lot of complaints from forensic linguists who said that it's really difficult to defend this type of work as scientific, which is important to do in a court of law these days when you're dealing with forensic science. When the linguistic expert is picking out the absence or presence of various markers, with nothing really to back up the significance of those markers beyond the forensic linguist's own expertise. So you can think of it something like an art connoisseur sniffing out a forgery. Here's just an example of what was seen as a bit tenuous about this analysis. Just to go back here, you could see that there were 11 style markers. Two of them were identified as similar, and 9 of them as dissimilar, and so that was enough to say that it was probable that these questionable emails were not actually from Zuckerberg. And so 2 of those 9 that were seen as dissimilar were these spelling ones here, which in the one collection of emails, you have the word internet spelled lowercase. And in the known Zuckerberg emails, these were actually from the Harvard University servers. We know that he actually wrote them. He used the word internet twice with a capital I. So 1 versus 2 tokens. This one with cannot has a little bit more. We've got cannot as 2 words used once in the questioned email. The known Zuckerberg emails where cannot appears as 1 word 6 times. But, you know, you have to wonder, is this really the best way to go about this type of work? So there's a lot of interesting research that's being done, some by researchers with a linguistics background where they're really looking at things like grammatical structures, which might be tracked through identifying sort of marked versus unmarked grammatical structures. And there are also computer scientists who are just trying to amass as many possible features to look at as possible without really delving into the syntactic issues. And yeah, they can get pretty good accuracy rates. And there are actually corpora available for them to train this these techniques on. So, for instance, if you want to find out, you know, how much can you tell from an email to identify an email as coming from a particular author, there are actually email corpora, even though people generally don't like to share their emails. But the Enron case led to the creation of the Enron email corpus, which all of the inter-office emails among the Enron employees are available for that. So it's possible even to just look at emails to see what might be identifiable as a feature that you could look at in this type of analysis. And that might be the position of greetings and farewells in the emails, the preference of a writer for using symbols or words, you know, dollar sign versus the word dollars. So these researchers say if you combine all these features, then you get what's called a write print. So this idea, though, that there's a fingerprint, a unique identifier that could be metaphorically applied to writing is a bit problematic, though, despite all of this research. And, of course, fingerprints themselves, it turns out, aren't all that great as identifiers, it turns out. But we obviously all have our own written quirks and mannerisms, but there's just too much internal variability in any person's body of writing to imagine we could take just a bit of it, a handful of emails, let's say, and recognize some sort of linguistic DNA. And that's all the more true when you're dealing with digital genres like text messages, instant messages, tweets, full of unusual spellings, innovative abbreviations. Often it depends a lot on what device we're using, you know, whether spell check is part of it or, you know, autocorrect and things like that. But if you're analyzing larger swaths of writing and transcribed speech, it becomes more plausible to accept that certain linguistic tells could emerge from a person's communicative flow. There's a social psychologist at the University of Texas named James W. Pennebaker, and he's used a word counting technique that linguists might think of as kind of a brute force technique. Again, he's not really interested in parsing or that sort of thing. It's really just basic word counting. But even using these sort of brute force techniques, he ends up coming up with some very interesting correlations between word frequencies of various kinds and points of interest, things that social psychologists and others care about, things like the probability of depression or the rates of which medical interventions are needed, how long relationships last between people, whether somebody's lying, who between a pair of speakers has a higher social status, lower social status. It's interesting because many of the significant effects that he's found, and I say significant within the sort of the realm of social psychology, the overall differences very often are slight, but they can still be called significant in this realm of study. They often deal with relative frequencies of function words. So function words are pronouns, articles, prepositions, auxiliary verbs, conjunctions. This is the connective tissue of language that we tend to ignore or misjudge in our metalinguistic awareness. We're good in the flow of conversation or the flow of written text, picking up on content words, nouns, action verbs, adjectives, verbs. But as Pennebaker warns in his book, we're pretty terrible at picking up function words. But this under-the-radar sneakiness is actually makes them quite suitable for this type of research and uncovering, as Pennebaker puts it, our traces of our social identity and individual psyche in everyday language use. And it also helps that these little words make up the vast majority of the most common words in the language, so that makes them easy to count, regardless of what type of text you're looking at, whether it's tweets or poetry or what have you. So Pennebaker himself says that this type of word counting approach is, you know, he calls it remarkably stupid, again, because it's just counting words. You can't recognize irony, sarcasm, or even, you know, basic contextual clues that might allow us to distinguish which meaning of a word is intended if there's more than one. But these so-called stupid programs have led to very interesting insights over the years. You know, he started off working with diary entries written by people suffering from depression, analyzing how people deal with traumatic moments, and, you know, writing about it seemed to help, but why? And his team created a program to read the diary entries automatically, count words related to different the rise of the machines. So they would count words related to different psychological states like anger, sadness, or more positive emotions. So, you know, they were able to create this kind of sentiment lexicon. But then also, you know, they started counting these function words, and they found that particularly pronouns were often the best indicator of improved mental health. And they found that recovery from trauma seemed to require a kind of, as he called it, perspective switching, reflecting on problems from different points of view, and that shifts in pronoun use actually could facilitate that. So from this research, he developed a text analysis software called Linguistic Inquiry and Word Count, L-I-W-C, pronounced Luke. You can find it online at luke.net. And, you know, here's an example of some of those social and cognitive words that are being counted by this program, in addition to all those function words. And so you have ones that are identified with positive emotion, negative emotion, and so forth. And that number is just the number of items that are identified under the different categories. You can go online and actually put a bit of text into Luke and try it online. I tried the paper that I'm presenting now, and it turns out that I use a lot of big words, over six letters. I'm kind of off the charts there. I also use a lot of articles. You can see at the bottom there, even more than what's identified as typical of formal texts. And that, you know, there are lots of interesting sort of social correlations that can be made that have to do with not just the style that one assumes when one is writing a particular type of text, like say a paper to present, but also the social roles that people take can end up correlating in interesting ways with these word frequencies. So, for instance, article use. If you use a lot of them, Pennebaker says that's associated not just with formal thinking, formal writing, but also men use more articles than women. Organized people use a lot of articles. I'm not terribly organized, so I'm not sure that works for me. Emotionally stable and older people. Anyway, I won't try to psychologize myself too much, but the book does have a lot of interesting applications of this Luke program, and it can now automatically assess frequencies of various words and word classes in a whole variety of languages. And interestingly, it's being used a lot these days with various types of online texts, including on Twitter. And so that leads us into Twitterology, where there have been a number of research projects that look at tweets in various languages in order to determine sentiment of various kinds. It can be political sentiment, you know, relating to political figures, how people feel about candidates, and how that might track with election results. For instance, obviously that has a lot of appeal to people in political marketing and other types of marketing. But, you know, here's a case where researchers were tracking tweets to look at on-the-ground sentiment over the course of the Arab Spring, particularly in Egypt and Libya. And this is research done at the University of Texas, where Pennebaker also teaches. The linguist David Beaver there at University of Texas and his assistants were tracking tweets coming out of Libya. And you can see that this was from October of last year. They published this October 30th, and this showed just from October 15th to October 22nd the ratio of positive emotion words versus negative emotion words in tweets that were known to be from Libya. And you can know this because Twitter has a kind of geocoding. So, for instance, you may know that if you tweet from a cell phone, you can actually tell Twitter your geographic coordinates. I'm amazed that people actually do this. They sort of geotag themselves. There's also the possibility of looking at the information provided just in the profile where you say where you are. So anyway, there are various ways of identifying people who are actually in Libya. They're tweeting in Arabic. In this particular round of analysis, the tweets were automatically translated from Arabic to English so they could be fed into the English language version of Luke. But in later work, they built up a sentiment lexicon in Arabic so that you wouldn't have to go through that translation step and introduce all sorts of artifacts from that. So you can see here's October, last October in Libya, and you can see this big spike of highly positive emotion associated also, you can see, with the color coding with a very high frequency. And you would know just by looking at the graph that something interesting was going on. And in fact, that was the precise moment when news came out that Gaddafi was dead. Sorry? No, this is Libya. This is all tweets from Libya. People in Libya tweeting in Arabic. They're identifiable as people who are on Twitter talking about events in their country. It's being analyzed back in Austin at the University of Texas because these tweets are available for anyone to look at if they're public. So what we see actually in this Twitter traffic, not just the positive and negative emotions, that with the overall traffic skyrocketing in the hours after Gaddafi's death, as well as the positive sentiment, you could also look at upticks in certain words, like good and wonderful, you know, the Arabic equivalents of those words. Religious sentiment of various kinds was also on display, a big increase in frequency of words like Allah, sacrifice, and gospel, again, sort of translating here. So there are various types of Twitterology that have been going on, use this kind of sentiment analysis, as this research is known. But if you look at it, one critique that may be obvious is it takes a rather naive view of emotional states, assuming that a person's moods can simply be divined from word selection. And that might seem particularly perilous in a medium like Twitter, where sarcasm, other playful uses of language often subvert the surface meaning. And Pennebaker himself warns that doing this type of analysis on just positive and negative emotion words, as identified by Luke, are what he calls the low-hanging fruit, and that you really do need a deeper analysis to provide a richer, more nuanced view of how people present themselves in the world. And that's why he tends to focus on function words and what they might be able to tell. So even though we can't expect Twitter to be an unerring emotional barometer, it's proving extremely valuable for understanding how language varies among different demographic groups. So there's a team of computational linguists at Carnegie Mellon, and they use, again, geocoded tweets, so you can really plot where people on a map, in this case in the United States, to look at regional language use. And the amount of data available for this kind of analysis is many, many orders of magnitude bigger than what could be collected with traditional dialect surveys involving questionnaires and linguistic fieldwork and so forth. Even when the torrent of tweets that a researcher might download using Twitter's streaming API, that's how you get access to all of this, you can turn it down from the fire hose setting. That's all publicly available messages just coming at you all at once, and you can download them as fast as you can if you have the storage space to do it. You can turn that down just to the garden hose setting. That's a 10% sample of all public messages, but given the traffic on Twitter, that's still millions of tweets per day that you can collect for various types of analysis. So one interesting thing you can do with that, if you're looking at American English, is look for patterns of informal English, like, for instance, the profusion of the word hella as a form of emphasis in Northern California, and how it actually spreads from Northern California. Those of you familiar with that word hella know that it can be used as to say it's hella cold out there, for instance, associated with Northern California. You could also look at slangy phonetic spellings or pronunciation spellings to see distinct patterns of distribution. Here's just a map that the Carnegie Mellon team put together using some data from 2010, where you can see that the variance shown here is something in the standard spelling, something spelled S-U-M-T-H-I-N, and Sutton, S-U-T-T-I-N. So various non-standard spellings, and you can find that there's a kind of a locus of use of Sutton, S-U-T-T-I-N, in New York, just as you might find that in California, writing cool as coo, spelled either K-O-O or C-O-O, which may indicate L vocalization in the dialect, is evident. Here's something else, another type of work that's done on the spellings of cool by researchers at University of Texas and Cornell, and they use a different type of plotting of the geography of all this, which is a little complicated, but it's the same basic idea that you can then take all of these variants of different forms and create maps, as traditional dialectologists have done, but do it on a much wider scale with huge amounts of language data, which can tell you even things about emoticons, for instance, how those might differ from region to region, those smiley and frowny text shorthands. So this type of dialect study is geographically focused, and it does, though, suggest the potential of more nuanced approaches to variationist sociolinguistics, drawing on all of this data. And in fact, there are some young scholars hard at work with these online language sources in places like Stanford and Carnegie Mellon, and they're actually melding computational methods of corpus analysis with insights from scholars like Penelope Eckert into what Eckert calls third-wave variation studies, where there's a focus on communities of practice rather than communities that are necessarily defined by some sort of static geography. You can instead look at all of these text variables, whether it's non-standard pronunciation spellings or anything else, for the construction of social identities and online discourse. In order to do that, though, you need a lot of technological savviness and a lot of sociolinguistic discernment, which is a combination of aptitudes that I'm happy to report I see with increasing frequency among younger scholars. Various grad students I've talked to are interested in doing this type of work. And that's good to see, because in the era of big data, it's going to be crucial to apply these interpretive insights, since abstract masses of linguistic data points, no matter how overwhelming in their abundance, can never speak for themselves. Thank you.